All right, good afternoon again. I've gotten the thumbs up that we can start. Okay. So welcome to the Miller Center. We are pleased that you are with us. Today we have a colloquium. Our speaker is Jeff Jenkins. He will be giving his paper, Speakership Elections Since 1860, The Rise of the Organizational Caucus, that he has written with Charles Stewart of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're going to give Jeff about 10 minutes to give you the bare bones of his argument, and then we will have commentary from Mike Holt, who's the Williams Professor of History here at the University of Virginia. Again, Professor Holt will have about 10 minutes, give or take, and then we'll open the floor to questions and comments. Okay. So without further ado, Jeff.
Thanks very much, David. Thanks for all turning out on a rainy Friday right before spring break. This is my second year at Virginia. The department's been very accommodating, and the Miller Center has been a great home for me. And I just want to thank everybody affiliated with the center and allowing me to present some of my research. This is a chapter of a book project that I've been working on with Charles Stewart of MIT. We've been working on this for a while. This particular chapter happens to be chapter 7 of the book project, so it's very near the back end of the book. So part of what I'll talk about in here is some of the backstory, some of the material that goes into some of the earlier chapters to give you a feel for what's happening in this chapter. And as you can see, the title of the book is Fighting for the Speakership, the House, and the Rise of Party Government. We've been writing this book for a long time, and actually some of the research for this book goes back to when I was in graduate school. And Stewart and I started writing papers when I was in graduate school, and we really started to write papers on this sort of topic when I was at my first job at Michigan State in 2000-2001. So we started to talk about doing a book together, you know, sort of knitting together some of the working papers that we had written as early as then. And over the years, we started to do more and more work. He took on an associate dean position, and now he's department head. So he's had a lot of administrative duties. He's had a lot of his attention drawn away from writing, and I've had my attention drawn to other projects. So we've been together for some time. The hope is that we'll have a full manuscript done by the beginning of this summer. The plan is to actually bring some academics out here to the Miller Center in July to provide what we call a scrub for the project, to read the manuscript in advance, the full manuscript in advance, and give us comments so that we can make some revisions before handing it over to our publishers. So that's the plan for late July right now. So in some ways, throughout the last number of years, I've felt a little bit like this book is akin to the white whale, right, trying to essentially slay the white whale. And I hope the whale is in my sights this coming June and July, so we'll have to see. So the main is to describe in detail how majority parties came to dominate the organization of the House of Representatives. And by organization, we mean control of the major offices, the speaker, the clerk, the printership, all the way down. Today, that sort of organization proceeds in a very pro forma fashion. We take it for granted. It's nothing that we even give much thought to. Right, the clerk establishes a quorum. There's balloting for Speaker of the House. Speaker's elected. That's followed by the election of a number of subordinate officers, usually all at once, and then the committees, the standing committees, are appointed. Okay. And so the outcomes are dictated directly by the majority party. And those outcomes, those decisions, stem from earlier decisions made within the majority party caucus. So our expectation now is to look at the election results in November, see which party wins a majority of seats in the House, and we just assume at the outset the majority party will then move forward and organize the House. And that was not always the case. During the antebellum period, in particular, there was a lot of contention, and there were a number of deadlocks over the organization of the House. And I think it's fair to say that you can characterize that sort of contentious spirit as fairly common. 13 of the 41 speakership contests before the Civil War required multiple ballots. Three in particular stand out. I'll have something a little bit more to say in the next slide, but 61 ballots in 1849, 133 ballots in 1855, 56, and 44 ballots in 1859, 60. You know, today, it's all over in an hour or thereabouts, right? That wasn't always the case. Moreover, the majority party lost the speakership at least twice, and the subordinate offices were also very much contested. The clerk of the House, 9 of those elections went multiple ballots. 4 of the printership elections went multiple ballots, and it wasn't at all uncommon for the majority party to lose at least one of these offices. So maybe to be successful in electing a speaker, but electing the other officers didn't always go along according to plan. The 31st Congress, so this is the first of the three major speakership battles before the Civil War. So it required 61 ballots. It took 3 weeks to elect a speaker. Eventually, Howell Cobb, a moderate Democrat from Georgia, down on the right, was elected over Robert Winthrop, a Whig from Massachusetts, who had been speaker in the 30th House. And this particular election required a change in the rules. They passed a plurality rule in order to elect a speaker. So we didn't actually have a majority elect a speaker in the 31st House. It was so contentious. And not unlike my previous slide, the Democrats would go on to lose one of the other subordinate offices, the clerkship in this particular case. In the 34th Congress, 1855-56, this took 133 ballots. It took 2 months to elect a speaker. Eventually, Nathaniel Banks, down there on the right, who was elected to the House from Massachusetts as a member of the American or the Know-Nothing Party, was elected over William Aiken, a Democrat from South Carolina, down there on the left. And again, like the 31st Congress, this also required the chamber to pass a plurality rule. So again, we don't have a majority rule in place. We don't have a majority actually electing a speaker. The Republicans would then go on to lose the printership, which many in the party, like Horace Greeley, thought was, you know, a terrible thing, even worse than potentially losing the speaker. Nathaniel Banks, down there on the right, has some history with the state of Virginia. He was one of the many politician generals during the Civil War and found himself kicked up and down what is the valley? The Shenandoah Valley. The Shenandoah Valley by Stonewall Jackson throughout the year 1862. So Banks was not terribly successful as a Union general. 36th Congress took 44 ballots in another 2 months. This time, William Pennington, former Whig, former governor from New Jersey, was elected over a spate of Democrats. The Democrats had really split apart on the House floor by that time. The plurality nominee at that point was John McClernand, a Democrat of Illinois. And this was a break from some of the previous contested elections that the Republicans would then go on to win all the officer positions. So this was, in some ways, a signal to Southern Democrats that the Republicans were beginning to consolidate and get their bearings as a national party. And obviously, the South would go on to secede in the not-too-distant future. Some of the backstory in the book, thinking about House organization as a partisan issue. So this arises during the second party system, during the Whig Democratic Party system. Martin Van Buren, who had been one of the chief moving forces behind the beginnings and the proposition of the mass party system, views the House organization and control of the House organization as one part of his broader party building goal. Okay, so he saw control of the Congress, and specifically in our work, the House, as a major part of mass party development. And he saw that control and continued control into the future over the elections of some of the major House officer positions as vitally important to provide any number of incentives for the development of the mass party. So the Speaker obviously appointed standing committees and decided on rules of order. So on policy matters, control of the speakership was vital. The House clerk employed dozens of workers and controlled a huge slush fund that he could use for patronage, okay? The clerk was also the interim presiding officer at the beginning of each new House before a new speaker was elected, and that's going to come into play in some of the stories that I tell in this particular chapter. And the printer was the information organ for the party. The printer controlled a large slush fund in his own right, which he used to subsidize the partisan press throughout the country. So in terms of allowing the Democratic or the Whig Party to essentially provide their message and disseminate their message, create and prop up newspapers throughout the country. The printer was a vital institution. And the printership would be a source of corruption during this time, 1850s and 1860s, when it was found out that the printer only needed to, you know, essentially use a very small portion of the money that he was allotted each and every Congress to actually undertake his duties. The remainder of his money was kicked back in various forms to the party for their use throughout the country in this mass party building initiative. The current paper that we'll be reading today, and we'll be talking about this again, is Chapter 7, looks at House organization between 1839 and 1859, and that was a very contentious time, the most contentious in American history. Five of the 11 speakership elections during this period required multiple ballots, and three of which were very lengthy, which I talked about before. The puzzle that this chapter begins to analyze is that beginning in 1861 with the 37th House, all contention on the House floor all but disappeared. Okay, so we saw lots of contention on the House floor before 1861, and then there's a shock, and it all disappears. It's all gone. So since 1861, only a single ballot has been needed to elect a speaker and other House officers, with one exception in 1923. Okay, so speakership election and other House elections have gone off pretty much without a hitch since 1861. And there's been almost no partisan defection in these elections. When you see a given party, the Republicans or the Democrats, nominate a candidate, all the partisans fall in line behind that nominee. So what happened? And that's really at the heart of this chapter. At first glance, you might think that slavery was dealt with, right, by the coming of the Civil War, the secession of the South. So contentiousness disappeared. And certainly the slavery issue is an important component of this overall story, but that basic account, that very simple account by itself, is wrong, because contentious spirit was still very much alive in any number of Congresses after that in some of these important elections, but it simply moves up a level. Right? The election battles that we see during the antebellum period would be replaced by nomination battles. So moving from the House floor into the majority party caucus. Okay, the venue for the arguments moves from the House floor to the majority party caucus. So what we see is lots of contentiousness within those caucuses over nominations, but once an outcome is reached in caucus, majority party members coalesce on the floor. All of the losers in these battles, in these intra-caucus battles, coalesce. They go along with what the majority in caucus wanted. So we don't see any splits, we don't see any fractures on the House floor. And the story we tell is this, this sort of disappearance of contentiousness is explained by conceiving of House organization as caucus-induced after 1861, where majority party members could go into caucus, they could behave freely, they could operate freely, they could vote freely, but once a slate of officer nominees was decided, all members were bound to support that slate, those officer nominees, on the floor. Okay, the speaker is a pivotal part of this caucus-induced agreement. The speaker, once in office, was then expected to share power via committee assignments with the rest of the party, especially the losers. So that portion of the membership that did not vote for the winning nominee in caucus, was expected to be compensated. So there was a power-sharing agreement. There was an influence-sharing agreement within the caucus. So that was the carrot in the carrot-stick agreement. The stick part is that defectors on the floor would expose themselves to punishment. Okay, so they could lose their committee assignments, they could lose some of their committee seniority, and the worst-case scenario is they could be expelled from the caucus. And we see some examples of that in this chapter. So the substantive highlights of the chapter, very quickly, and this is just an outline of the chapter, a nice one-slide outline of that 80-page chapter. The rise of the organizational caucus begins under the Republicans. There's a coup attempt in the 38th Congress. So the clerk who was elected from the 37th, who had been a unionist, who was brought into the Republican Party as a way to appeal to some of the border states, blanches at Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And he is going to use his authority to try to undermine the Republican Party in the 38th Congress. And he almost wins, he almost succeeds. The Republicans get wind of his coup attempt, they beat him back, and they're able to elect their speaker and other officer nominees. But it becomes clear to the Republicans, who had the two Congresses beforehand, who had allowed their members to essentially vote their true preferences on the floor and then coalesce behind whichever candidate received the most votes in the first round. So beginning with the 38th Congress, they now realize that that strategy of allowing Republicans to essentially position take on the House floor could create some threats. So rather than deal with any potential threats that could expose the party on the House floor, they pulled back the decision-making to the caucus and allowed members to kind of sort out within the caucus, and then they could go to the House floor with a slate of nominations. And through the 60s and the 70s, it's very successful. We don't see any defection. We see the Republicans being very successful in their nomination patterns and their election patterns on the House floor. The Democrats are watching this as members of the minority. When they finally get back into the majority in the mid-1870s, they follow suit, and they take up this caucus-induced strategy as well. We see a couple major nomination battles during the latter part of the 19th century. So as currency issues and tariff issues become very prominent and cross-cut both the Democrats and the Republicans, we see those cross-cutting elements filter into the caucus decisions of both major parties. So the Republicans had a 16-ballot affair in the 47th House in 1881. So Frank Hitchcock from New York battled against J. Warren Kiefer in Ohio, and Kiefer comes up as the winner. In 1891, in the Democratic caucus required 30 ballots in 2 days before nominations could move forward. Mills in Texas ran against Chris from Georgia, and Chris came up as the winner there. And then the back end of this chapter looks at the only outlier floor battle after 1861. So the only time when an unhappy part of the majority party caucus decided to take their grievances to the House floor. And this occurs in the 68th Congress in 1923, when a number of progressive Republicans from the Midwest were unhappy with Republican leadership over procedural matters. They felt that a lot of policy issues were being held up in committee, and that their grievances, their policy grievances, were not being heard. So they wanted the Republican speaker to make some procedural changes, right? Produce some discharge petition that would allow some large member or some large percentage of the underlying membership to pull bills out of committee, right? They wanted to prevent committee chairmen from essentially stopping the will of committee majorities through the pocket veto. So they broke from the Republican establishment. They battled with the old guard Republicans on the House floor. There were two days and 8 ballots before party leaders gave in and allowed them some discretion on some of these procedural matters. And once that was the case, these progressive Republicans came home, and on the 9th ballot, a speaker was elected. Once the old guard, once the regular Republicans got enough numbers in the 69th House, those progressive Republicans were punished. They were kicked out of the caucus initially. They had their committee seniority stripped, and they were only let back into the party after they agreed to support the speaker. So they came home with their tail between their legs in the 70th Congress. And that's a brief outline of this chapter, and I'm very interested to hear some of Professor Holt's. It's the first time I've had a chance to meet you, so it should be a blast, and all of your comments as well.
Thank you. I doubt that I'll take 10 minutes, but maybe so. The chapter, I wrote these comments on the assumption that many of you have read the paper, but that may be a mistaken assumption. The chapter describes, and this is a term he uses, the institutionalization of caucus control over major parties' nominations for Speaker of the House. It argues that this institutionalization began in the Civil War and has continued ever since. And my remarks are really going to focus on the part of the paper I know anything about, which is the era before, during, and after the Civil War. To my mind, the chapter raises at least three major questions. First, granted that the disappearance of multi-ballot elections of the Speaker on the House floor was a new development starting with the Civil War Congresses, was the disciplinary authority of the partisan caucuses over how party members voted in speakership contests, a new phenomenon, as Jeff argues in this chapter. Take, for example, I'm delighted that he had a little slide of it, the prolonged 61 ballot contest at the start of the 31st Congress in December of 1849. What primarily explains that lengthy deadlock is that neither the Democrats nor the Whigs had a majority. And the rule was that the Speaker had to have a clear and absolute majority of the vote. Instead, there were two dissident groups that held the balance of power between the parties, about seven or eight Free Soilers and six Southern Whigs who had bolted the Whig caucus before the meeting, the opening of Congress, because Northerners refused to promise not to try to introduce the Wilmot Proviso that would bar slavery from Western territory. But when they bolted the caucus, Alexander Stevens, Robert Toombs, Henry Hilliard, they vowed never to support the caucus's nominee for speaker, who was Robert C. Winthrop of Massachusetts, who'd been the speaker in the 30th Congress. Winthrop was also anathema to some, but not all, Free Soilers, especially Free Soilers who came from with Whig backgrounds like Joshua Giddings and what was it, Joseph Root. These Ohioans really hated Winthrop. Nonetheless, with the exception of those six Southerners who bolted the caucus before it nominated Winthrop, and one of those Southerners quickly returned to the Whig fold, the Whigs who'd remained in the caucus, including 24 Southerners, stuck by Winthrop to a man, every single one of them for 39 straight ballots. This seems like caucus discipline to me, and it suggests that it's not a new phenomenon that only appeared in the Civil War. The second question that I would raise, and which frankly, Jeff, I don't think you adequately answer, is what explains the sudden shift? You tell us what happened, but why did it happen in the 1860s? During the Civil War and Reconstruction, relying primarily on a secondary or secondary sources, you ascribe this essentially to the gravity of the situation during the Civil War. There are big problems, we can't have any squabbles, let's get down to business. That surely played a part, but I think the political fluidity of the war and Reconstruction years also played an important part. For one thing, many of the anti-democratic congressmen elected in 1860, 1861, 1862, and 1863 in the North did not run as Republicans. They refused to adopt the Republican Party label. As I told Jeff when we were talking before, both of us used Michael Dubin's book about the congressional election results. But Dubin is absolutely wrong in identifying the congressmen elected from Pennsylvania and New Jersey in 1860 as Republicans. They ran on People's Party platforms. They wrote to Lincoln after his election, including many of the these People's Party successful People's candidates for Congress. James K. Moorhead from my own town of Pennsylvania, for one, who'd been a Democrat, or Pittsburgh, who'd been a Democrat as late as 1858. They wrote Lincoln and said, "We're toast if we're ever called Republicans in Pennsylvania. We can never win. The Democrats will retake control of the state. We cannot be seen as associating with or being called Republicans." So you have then in the spring New England elections, you have a lot of that are held before this special session meets in July 4th. You have people in Rhode Island and Connecticut also staying away from the Republican Party label. They're running as unionists or something else. So I would suggest that one reason that there was no caucus held in July 4th when the Congress met was that what would you call it? If you called it Republicans, you wouldn't get everybody you wanted in it. You might have called it an administration caucus, but that could still scare people off. It also, I would also suggest that the reason that Galusha Groh of Pennsylvania was the guy that was picked as speaker of that session was precisely to get those people's parties, Pennsylvanians, into a coalition. So there was coalition formation going on in that session. And as I think Jeff makes clear, if you've read the paper, actually the caucus in December 1863 does not call itself a Republican caucus. It calls itself a Unionist caucus because they're trying to get Unionists from the Upper South. I mean, one of the it's very interesting if you look at Table 1 that the others, nobody had a majority in the 38th Congress. You have 27 others. That hold the balance of power, and you want to attract them with a unionist party rather than a straight Republican name. So there was, I gave a paper at the Abraham Lincoln Association out in Springfield several years ago debating a famous argument that the Union had a great advantage in the Civil War because it continued to have a two-party system, and the Confederacy did not. This is Eric McKittrick's argument. And the paper I gave was that there was no two-party system during the Civil War. And if you actually look at the congressional election results, a very large percentage of races for House seats in 1861, 62, and 63 were not two-party races between Republicans and Democrats. They were multi-candidate races using all different kinds of labels. As soon as the Civil War, indeed within a week of Appomattox, moreover, within a week, you have a Republican senator from Connecticut writing to a friend, "With the war over and slavery abolished, there must be a reorganization of parties. The Republicans and Democratic parties have both outlived their usefulness." And this kind of talk was widespread both in newspapers and in private correspondence. It continued throughout Reconstruction. Here, again, it seems to me, was an incentive to have that caucus discipline, because the last thing you wanted was a multi-ballot, multi-candidate race for speaker that might precipitate this sort of partisan reorganization that people were predicting throughout Reconstruction. So I think there, not necessarily alternative explanations, but additional explanations for why this development, which is very clearly different from the antebellum period, occurred when it did. The third question, which I again I mentioned to Jeff before when we were out eating or when I met him, is this: was the emergence of internal party discipline in the House unique to the House? And if so, why? Jeff and his co-author are finishing up the book, and they'll probably have little interest in pursuing this suggestion. But I think one could make a very fruitful comparison between the pattern over time in elections for speaker and the power of the caucuses in the House with state legislative elections of United States senators in the 19th century, where caucus nominees were made in each party, and the you know, angry minorities would often bolt and back the candidate of the other party. Did that have the same time trajectory, that is? I mean, I know this happened all the time prior to the Civil War, but was the same sort of discipline imposed on state parties after the Civil War? And if it wasn't, if they couldn't impose it, what was so unique about Congress that allowed these caucuses to exert that discipline? That's it for me.
Thank you, Professor Holt. Thank you, Jeff. Professor Jenkins, sorry. We will now entertain questions from the audience. Let's get a couple of let's get to some audience involved just before we run out of time. We'll make sure there's time for you at the end.
Okay.
But these are paying customers, so we want to make sure that they have a chance to be heard. I don't see any hands. Oh, Professor Ballo. And please, note, please speak loudly into the mic. Your voice is being broadcast around the world.
Brian Ballo. In the history department and chair of the Gage program here at the Miller Center. Jeff, what do you think of Mike's comments?
They're all three very good comments. So I'll run through them. So the first one was, as I scribble down quickly, was disciplinary authority in the caucus a new phenomenon? So the argument that we're making here in this chapter is that the caucus as a real tool of disciplining members starts during the Civil War. What do we see before the Civil War? Well, so how does all of this start? I guess is one way to kind of answer that question. So, and this requires me to kind of talk a little bit about some of the earlier chapters. The Congressional Caucus was an important device in the early part, the late 18th century and early 19th century, as a way of electing presidents, as a way of nominating presidents, right? So the Congressional Caucus was a king caucus. So the way that you got a nomination for, you know, a party to run as president was, it was done through the Congressional Caucus. That ends around 1824, right? We see an attempt to bring back the caucus in a different form at the end of the 1830s, right? So, as I mentioned, I think in one of the earlier slides, Martin Van Buren had perceived the caucus as a very useful tool in his mass party building strategy. Well, what was on his mind? What was he thinking? Well, in the late 1830s, as the Whig Party was beginning to form in opposition to the Democratic Party, the Democrats were finding that or Democratic leaders were finding that any number of individual Democrats were being bid away on some of these elections. Conservative elements within the Democratic Party would oftentimes vote with the Whigs on various organizational matters. And at that time, speakership election and the election to the other House officer positions was by secret ballot. So party leaders were not, they were aware that they weren't getting as many votes as they should have been getting from their party. They weren't aware of who was defecting. They had some idea. But in order to identify exactly who was defecting and be able to punish them, Van Buren pushed through his toadies in Congress the move toward a public ballot, to move from secret balloting to viva voce. So that was one rung. And in addition to that, you combine this move to public balloting with a venue to sort out partisan differences. And that's how the caucus was brought back. So what Van Buren had in mind is a way to kind of stymie this problem and to prevent it from getting worse was hearkening back to what he had done as leader in New York, in New York State. Van Buren had essentially instituted a public ballot and had decided many party matters within caucus. So he was just replicating that. He was trying to replicate that in the late 1830s. Okay, so that's one way of answering the question, was disciplinary authority in caucus a new phenomenon? And to Van Buren, the answer was no. Van Buren had some definite experience with this. Now, going state by state is a different matter. I mean, just jumping very quickly from that point to Professor Holt's third point, was the emergence of inter-party discipline unique in the House? I suppose if you gave me several millions of dollars and at least a decade, I could probably answer that. Our data of state legislative politics in the 1980s is terrible, let alone the 1840s or 1850s. The data just hasn't been collected. My co-author, Charles Stewart, has spent the last few years, while he's not been working on this project, collecting data on state legislative elections for senators, which has never been collected prior to the 17th Amendment. You know, it just seems to boggle your mind that we don't have that data, but it has never been collected. In the course of his going through some of that data and my going through some of the newspapers, I would see occasionally pop up speakership battles at the legislative level and many multi-ballot speakership elections in different states. And you would certainly, if you had the data and you had the knowledge of how those state legislative systems were set up, you would be able to identify variation across those states. It should lend you some idea which states are more likely to have speakership battles versus others. First thing that pops into my head is secret ballot. If some states still have a secret ballot, that's an incentive for dissident party members to essentially sell their votes without fear of being caught, without fear of being punished. That's just one thought. Going back to question number one, Professor Holt had talked about the 1849 case and how a lot of Southern Whigs had stuck behind Winthrop in the speakership election. And I think that's the case. That by itself is not evidence of caucus, that is consistent with the caucus being a disciplinary authority, but it is not evidence of the caucus.
The Whigs caucused every single night after the ballot days, and they recommitted themselves to Winthrop. So, I mean, the caucus was involved in that.
The caucus was involved, but whether members were voting with Winthrop because he was a cotton Whig, right, which is what he was, which is what allowed him to get elected to the 30th House, or whether they were fearful of punishment is a different question, right? So this is, in some sense, this is social science, right? We want to find evidence that is not only consistent with an argument,
so
but
internal cohesion is not evidence of discipline.
It is. It would be supportive of that argument. It could be. It would. It might be supportive of another argument or two, which is that Winthrop simply was willing to give them what they wanted. He was a cotton Whig, after all. Question number two: what explains the sudden shift? Okay, this is one that we've gotten. I've presented this a couple of other places, and this is a very fair question, and I tried. It's been a while since I revised this chapter. I've been presenting it at different places and jotting down comments, and you know, probably in May or so, I'll go back and do a bunch of revisions. But other people have asked this question. I think the chapter hinges on an answer to this, right? So why in the 37th House? You know, why do we see election battles on the House floor up until 1861, and they suddenly disappear, and that allows for this caucus-induced system that Van Buren had thought up in the late 1830s to finally take hold. A couple ways to answer that question. The first relies upon the slavery issue as being such a divisive issue that inter-party cohesion was nearly impossible before the Civil War. So slavery was one of those issues in which members of Congress feared voting the wrong way. They feared their constituents more than they feared their party leaders. So they voted with their district or with their states, depending upon whether we're talking about the House or the Senate, and essentially took their chances with the leadership. I think it's fair to say, and there are lots of ways that I could make this argument, that there has never been as a divisive issue in American politics, especially American congressional politics, over time, from 1789 to the present, than slavery in the 1850s, 1840s and 1850s. You had the currency issue in the late 19th century, you had tariff issues, you had civil rights in the 1960s, you had some immigration issues in the 1920s. And these would all manifest themselves in a lot of the data that I look at as important but secondary dimensions, right? The major dimension typically in Congress is a basic left-right dimension on standard economic terms, right? To what degree do you believe the government, the federal government, should be taking a strong or a weak hand in national economic affairs? So from the first federal Congress to the current time, that first dimension has been consistent, except in the late 1840s and 1850s, or the mid-1850s through the mid-1870s, when a slavery, Civil War, Reconstruction dimension becomes the prominent dimension in Congress that structures roll call voting. Never again have we seen a secondary issue, a secondary mention, emerge and usurp control over the congressional environment. So there was something special about slavery. There was something special about the slavery issue that prevented the Van Buren strategy from taking hold. Once slavery was taken off the agenda, the Van Buren strategy that he had, you know, thought up in the late 1830s was able to take hold, right, with the Republicans. The Republicans were not an interregional coalition. They did not have to worry about coalitions in both the North and the South. As such, they were fairly homogenous, right? There were differences among some of the Republicans, but not great differences. So you had a fairly homogenous party who all members saw essentially eye to eye on most of the major issues of the day. That allowed for that sort of caucus agreement to take hold, right? Homogeneity is important in this argument. Once that caucus-induced environment sort of took hold for a good decade and a half, it was seen as a useful institution by Democrats and Republicans thereafter, right? The way that power was shared, the way that influence was shared within the caucus was mimicked, was seen as a useful and vital institution. The point about Republicans in 1861, 62 not being Republicans, we had talked about this. I rely upon the Dubin book. I rely upon Ken Martis's party codes from this era. I wasn't aware of these sorts of issues before.
Unfortunately, I wrote my dissertation about Pittsburgh. That's why I know about it. There's People's Party stuff.
So this is something, you know, and my recollection of... My recollection of Dubin is that, and I have to go back, and Dubin's pretty good about citing his sources for all of these elections. My recollection is that he uses state newspapers for a lot of these sources. So going back to a couple of the key states, I'd have to go back and see what he uses as the sources. And maybe they're not newspapers. Maybe he's using some other secondary sources to infer party codes. On the point about Galusha Groh in the 37th, Groh was not a caucus nominee. So the Republicans don't start with a binding caucus until the 38th Congress. So essentially, the Republican Party allowed members to come and vote their true preference on the House floor. And then with the understanding that everyone, the losers, the Republicans who did not support the individual who got the most votes, would then coalesce behind the winning vote getter. So I think this particular issue about Republican coding and who was and who wasn't a Republican isn't so directly related to the caucus argument, because the caucus wasn't making the decision in the 37.
No, my point was simply that Groh was perceived as the front runner going into the election, probably because he was a lord of those Pennsylvanians who were calling themselves People's Party's men rather than Republicans.
That could very well be. Groh was safe on the slavery issue. Groh was a clear anti-slavery candidate, which was most important to the Republican Party at that time. You take a look at some of the other candidates who were running. Frank Blair from Missouri, Francis Blair Jr. from Missouri, was, relatively speaking, a lightweight relative to Groh. So Groh was something of a heavyweight in the party at this time. So that's also a factor. You know, all of these.
He was also an anomaly. I mean, a Republican getting elected in Missouri.
Well, he was a Free Soil Democrat initially, right? So, he, like many of the Republicans, they were mongrels, right? I mean, they came from, you know, different histories, right? Some were.
This guy later becomes famous as the Democratic Party's vice presidential nominee in 1868, where he's the most racist politician in the 19th century. The same Frank Blair.
In a sense, those are some of my answers. And I think one of the key points, and it's still up on this slide here, is, you know, apart from the benefits of the caucus as an institution, theoretically, in a broad theoretical way, it was a pragmatic response to the intrigue that was brewing at the beginning of the 38th Congress, right? So in lieu of continuing with the pattern of allowing party members to come to Congress and vote their true preference on the first ballot that the Republicans had pursued in the 36th and 37th Congress, they recognized that, you know, the clerk was up to no good there. And they needed to essentially get their act together before they got to the House floor. And they did that through the caucus. So the caucus, in addition to being an offensive weapon into the future, was also a defensive weapon, right? You know, there is some benefit to essentially allowing your partisans to vote the way they want on the House floor, right? They can make a nod to their home districts or their home states, right? You know, vote for favorite sons on the first ballot, and then coalesce behind the leader. That also opens up dangers, right? Pitfalls. And Republicans were very aware of that after the, you know, the failed intrigue with Emerson Etheridge.
Thanks, Jeff. Eric Potashnick, Politics Department. It seems like most of the action in the paper is the caucus. It's the caucus recognizing the problems of disorganization, of uncertainty, and struggling to find a solution that will promote gains for the whole caucus. And I'm wondering if, and one of the things that I think is really interesting about this is you're sort of going back to the moment of institutional origins. When do we get this sort of durable form that lasts, that persists through time? So that makes it very timely and interesting. But I wonder if you could press on two other factors that are already sort of raised in Michael's remarks, and that is the first is individual agency, the role of individuals who are making decisions here that end up having far-reaching consequences. So I was struck, I don't know this period well, but I was struck by Colfax and Blair especially, making the decision not only to pull out, but to endorse and to tell their supporters to switch their votes. That seems like an act, a consequential political act, and I want to know more about why was this key actor doing this? Was this just solving a problem of the collective, or what was the motivation there? That was one. The second is the story seems mostly to be an internal story to the House, and it's just this caucus existing. At moments, it seems in a vacuum, solving its own problems, but there are external forces here. There are constituents, there are newspapers, there are voters, there are presidents, there's the Senate. To what degree can we understand, and there's courts, obviously, there's states, there's lots of external factors. Can we understand the development of this institution by looking only at the institution, or do we need to situate this institution in the larger social context that it's embedded in?
Okay, two good questions. How important is individual agency? So the story that Eric is bringing up is that, you know, in the election of the 37th House, Groh is the leading vote getter, right? And, you know, Frank Blair, before the clerk tallies up all of the votes, gains the floor and essentially tells all of his voters, 40-some-odd at that time, to essentially endorse Groh rather than, you know, sort of go to a second ballot or go to, you know, any number of extended ballots, right? So so that only a single ballot would be needed, or at least in terms of the direction of the announcement to the rest of the world that just a single ballot was needed to elect the speaker. How important was that, or why? Why might we think that that's important, or why might we think that that is part of a larger story? You know, part of that could simply be, in my recollection of some of the stories up until that point, is that that was the agreement that was made in the 36th Congress as well. That there was this tacit agreement between all party members that party leaders or party members would be allowed to vote for whom they wanted on the first ballot, with the understanding that they would then move to the front runner on subsequent ballots. Why would Blair essentially step in and essentially prevent that from happening, right? Short-circuiting that, right? Letting things move on. I could tell some off-the-cuff answers, I suppose, right? Blair was trying to be a statesman. Right, Blair was recognizing that this was a critical point in American history, right, during the first Civil War Congress, and you wanted your party to look as organized as possible moving forward. It's not going to be a factor in any future elections, right, because we're going to get a first ballot election after that, right, and it's not because of this sort of arrangement, right, it's not going to require someone to stand up and shift his or her support into the future. that happens without this, right? It simply follows the caucus agreement. So I'm not really sure what more to say about individual agency, because in my mind, individual agency only comes into play in the 37th House, not after, in terms of leaders. Other factors being important. I think this in some ways is a question about how much we want to tell a general story versus a precise story, right? As social scientists, we make decisions all the time about how precise we want to be, right? How clear we want to be about the story that we want to tell. In thinking about the organization more generally, House organization more generally, and the move to the caucus-induced system, it's not obvious to me that a lot of those other factors that you mentioned would have mattered. I'm not sure why the courts themselves would have mattered in terms of majority party leadership moving toward a caucus system. I could speak a little bit about the Senate, right? The Senate was always a much more free-form environment than the House. The Senate doesn't have formal leadership positions until the 1890s, right? Never had a speaker. You only see the majority leader tag come into play in the 1890s, right? You had, you know, some battles over the printership and the secretary position in the Senate. But, you know, in some ways, the question, I guess, for us is, to what extent do we feel like the story we're telling as a House-specific story or a Congress-specific story passes the sniff test, right? Where does it seem to break down, and where do those breakdowns occur vis-a-vis where we think other factors might come into play? And I think at least I'm fairly comfortable telling a House-specific story. Other people, you know, are certainly free to suggest where and why and how some of these other factors might come into play. But they're not obvious to me.
Eric, can I just, before this other question, supplement, a friendly amendment to just, I think he said that after the 37th Congress, individual agency wasn't important. I would disagree, since we know the people who want to get the nomination for the speaker are writing letters. They're trying to round up as many votes as they can before the caucus meets. That's individual agency.
Yeah, fair enough.
What's your unfriendly?
I think that's fair. There were nomination campaigns during this time. So there, but I'm not sure. There were individual campaigns in the 1840s, and the 1850s, when we saw lengthy speakership battles. I spent the summer reading newspapers. I saw this. I'll pass on chapter 4 to you, so you can read that.
Mike wrote those.
Yes, ma'am.
I understand that your parameters are within certain things, but within certain earlier dates. But can you make this applicable to 2009? Are there things that are going on within the parties that the public itself is unaware of? Disciplinary roles.
I think that the body of research on Congress in the last 15 years or so in political science is, at least one wing of this body of research has been predicated on the disciplinary actions of the caucus, the party caucus. I'm telling a story here about the rise of what I would call an organizational cartel. Right, a group of people who try to essentially get together and take control of the organization. The political science literature tells a story starting with the Democrats in the 1980s, but really more seriously moved by Gingrich and Hastert when the Republicans took control of the House as the rise of a procedural caucus, a procedural cartel. So has the cartel been used in recent years to threaten and punish members? And the answer is yes, and it's been on certain types of issues. The argument has been, and the data is consistent with this, is that party leaders, the speaker, has been very insistent that majority party members go along with party dictates on procedural issues. So votes on rules, organization votes, votes that the general public wouldn't really be aware of, to essentially set the stage for the eventual policy votes, the votes that you guys would know a little bit about, right? To set the agenda, to allow for party leaders to structure those policy votes in such a way that they get what they want. And if members defect on those procedural votes, they put their futures at risk within the party. The argument has been, and the data is consistent with, once you actually get to those policy votes, members are allowed to vote as they like. So what leaders want is to be able to structure the agenda. And once the agenda is structured, then individual members can essentially vote however they like, okay? But the way that the way that the agenda is structured is something that we don't know a lot about as citizens, right? All we know is, well, X passed or not, X policy passed or not. Well, X policy may not have been, X policy may have been set up as a vote on the bill itself versus the status quo with no amendments allowed, with very little debate allowed, right? With those sorts of procedural votes that set up that eventual vote, right? So the it could very well be that most members would have preferred to vote on a different policy, right? Vote in a different way than what was set up.
These earmarks that they're talking of, is that some of the rewards, these earmarks that get passed, is that some of the rewards for falling in?
In today's world, you know, party leaders have lots of goodies that they can hand out, right? So there is partisan discretion over earmarks, right? The party leaders themselves in both the House and the Senate have, in the last 15 or 20 years, have started to campaign and get campaign contributions sent directly to them so that they can distribute to members whoever they like, right? And you distribute it to members who have been loyal. You distribute it to members who will be facing a tough re-election battle, especially to members who have been loyal and face a tough re-election battle, right? So there are any number of what I would call carrots that party leaders have today to essentially allow them to procedurally control the agenda.
There's a question. Oh, there's a question on the side over here. We'll get to you last, Sid. Okay.
Thank you very much. Penny Holt, resident of Charlottesville. I'm wondering if in your book you discuss what is lost in the political process when the shift to organizational caucus occurs. Do you get into that? Do you discuss that at all? What is lost?
What sort of loss are you thinking about?
Well, just in terms of in terms of the political process, do you think that something was lost in this shift? I mean, some kind of, I realize that, you know, you mentioned how contentious the situation was mm-hmm. until the slavery issue was resolved. But do you get into that at all? I mean, what?
Yeah, no, so
in sort of evaluating what?
Yeah, so you're asking in some ways about normative issues, right? I've thought a little bit about this. In moving to a system of, let's say, weak parties to strong parties, right? What you know, we can think about some of the benefits that can accrue from that, right? As political scientists, we don't often think about some of the costs that may be involved, right? So what would be lost? Individual liberty within the party, right? So as an individual member's ability to essentially vote his or her free will, right? So once you leave the caucus, starting in the 38th Congress, you're expected to follow the party dictates, right? You've essentially given up some of your personal liberty in order to be part of that organization. You would probably receive some value for that, right? You are now part of the winning coalition. You're gonna be more likely to get some of the goodies from the majority party that you can then send back home. But it does come at a cost, right? So you can't freely vote for whomever you want on the House floor for speaker. You can't vote for some of these other officer positions perhaps as you would like. You're essentially following the caucus dictate. It's the same thing with procedural issues, right? Today, right, as an individual member of Congress, you think that perhaps your constituents may prefer a moderate bill, right? So you have, let's say you're a moderate Republican in the late 1990s, right? You have, and regardless of what issue we're talking about, we have a status quo policy that's liberal, or that's somewhat liberal, right? You think your constituents would like a move from a fairly liberal, somewhat liberal policy to a moderate policy, right? The party wants to move from a somewhat liberal policy to a somewhat conservative policy. And they expect you to vote in accordance with the procedures to create a system, or to create a scenario in which the final vote is the somewhat conservative policy versus the somewhat liberal policy. You're not afforded an opportunity to give your constituents that moderate policy because of going along with caucus dictates on procedures. So in some ways, you're giving up some of your, you're giving up some of your individual liberty, you're giving up some of your individual responsibility to your constituents to be part of a party. Now, I think there are benefits that go along with that as well, right? Your constituents may have to decide, okay, I can't, you know, the decision is not presented to them, but many of them may find that they would prefer a somewhat conservative policy to a somewhat liberal policy. They might prefer the moderate policy, that might be their first choice, but that's not on the table, right? So they, at the end, have to think about what is my second best case, what is my second best preference, and it might be akin to what the party is providing as a whole.
Question down over here.
Hi, I'm Emily Charnock, a grad student in the politics department. When I was reading through your paper, one of the things that you talked about was that part of this story with the speakers being able to maintain party cohesion was that they could give out committee chairmanships to sort of compensate the losers. And it made me sort of think about an alternative story of institutionalization that Nelson Polsby offers, which is about the sort of rise of automatic procedures for assigning committee chairmanships through seniority. I guess part of it is just a question that I'm forgetting his periodization and how that maybe overlays with yours. But also with the rise of seniority, does that affect the sort of inducement side of your story?
Yeah, I think a good chunk of the back end of this paper is predicated on the speaker and other party leaders having inducements to give out, right? Having the ability to parcel out power. And during a good chunk of this period, say between 1861 and the second or third decade of the 20th century, there was a good deal of discretion with regard to committee assignments and committee chairmanships, right? So we only begin to see seniority as a norm come into play in terms of allowing, essentially this institutionalization after the fall of canon. Right, so the decade after the fall of canon do we see seniority become a useful norm in thinking about this. But at the same time, I think there's literature out there. Cox and McCubbins have a chapter in their first book looking at the Polsby thesis. And I think the Polsby thesis has been very influential, right? That article was written in 1968. And I think over the next 40 years, a number of individual scholars have taken various parts of that article and shown them to be untrue, right? And it's not that it was an influential paper. It got us to think, right? We wouldn't have come to some of those conclusions without that argument. But I think reading the Polsby article in a vacuum is problematic. Cox McCubbins in a chapter of their book, find that there were a number of seniority violations during this textbook era, and the violations occurred when individual members were not loyal, were not sufficiently loyal. So you can tell a story whereby there is this automated seniority process, right, whereby you get to keep your assignment or you get to keep your chairmanship, and I think that's fair as long as you also, sort of ascribe this condition that you had to be sufficiently loyal. Because it was always within the purview of party leaders to be able to strip them of that seniority. This was never the seniority rule, or the seniority process, was never a house rule. It was never a caucus rule. This was always a norm. Okay, there was nothing formal or binding about this. Right? Seniority was only respected as long as party leaders continued to respect it. So it could be an inducement, right? You continue to keep your committee assignments and your chairmanships as long as you maintain some threshold of loyalty to the party. So I think in that respect, I think Polsby's right.
We have time for one more question. This gentleman over here.
I'm Milt Edgerton, a retired surgeon. I was interested in your comments about the apprenticeship position, where I gather the taxpayers' money was used overtly to support partisan politics. Did this position die out? And if so, how did it die out, or do we have something like it that we don't recognize in the current?
It dies out in 1861 because any number of these corrupt acts came to fruition, right? The public became aware of these things. There were any number of congressional hearings in the 1850s and early 1860s exposing a lot of this corruption. So again, the argument is, and what was discovered is that the printer was responsible for doing certain things in his role as printer. Over time, it was found that the printer only needed some small portion of the money that was accrued to him every Congress in order to carry out that job. He then used the remainder of his money to either prop up printing presses throughout the country or to directly kick some of that money back to party leaders who could then overtly give money to campaigns, give money to individuals to run their campaigns. This comes to light in the 1850s and the early 1860s, and the printership positions in both the House and the Senate are eliminated, and the GPO is created, the Government Printing Office, which we still know today. So essentially, the feds take control of this operation, and it's no longer part of the patronage process.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you all for your attendance, and join me in thanking Melissa Holt and Jenkins.